Thank you very much. Brishus Rosh Yeshiva, Rosh Kolel, Merabosai. This is a long talk, so listen quickly. I have to get it done by 10 o'clock. We go back to this freezing, frigid peppermint patty. You don't even know what that means. All right, try and imagine. Lithuanian town, appropriately named Kul, where a woman named Freda, she had the monopoly on all the Hachnasas Orchim in town. Whoever come to town, and I don't mean the VIPs or the very mechubid, but the malodorist, odorific, farstunken, redolent, they would come to her house, and she had what was referred to as a pot-bellied stove for reasons of its appearance. And these people were so freezing, instead of going to a side room to sleep, they'd sleep right there in the living room so they could warm their freezing bones. And when they were asleep, this Freda would unravel. They had what I call poor man's boots. They couldn't even afford a pair of shoes or boots. They had strips of cloth, which they wrapped around their feet, that again were verstunken and redolent, and she would unravel them and launder them and give them a pleasant scent and then put them next to the fire, and they wake up in the morning, there's something humane to put around their feet. That's the grandmother of our protagonist. His mother, Italia, it was 9 children that owned poverty that we cannot even fathom. They owned 1 pair of shoes. So she would, 1 pair of shoes, and so she would take the daughter to school, we're talking about in the blizzard, untie the shoes, come home, and then take the boy to cheder. Untie the shoes, come and take the next child. Now, we all know that we or our wives despise carpool, but we have creature comforts and a windshield wiper. This is a blizzard going every day. That's the home in which you grew up. And we're talking about Yosef Shlomo Kuler, as he was referred to, from the town of Kul. People are always referred to the town they came from. It's funny, not like, but it is somewhat funny. I've heard people say about Rabbi Salanter. Salanter was not his last name. He's from the town of Salant. So people call from the town they came from. Many such examples. The Stiper is called the Stiper because he came from Horno Stiple. His last name, of course, was Kanievsky. So Yosha Kuler gets this really, he's a very clever boy. And one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells is vacationing in the area. He's giving a shir over Shabbos, and he attends the shir. He's a 12-year-old. And so Rosh Shimon Shkup, the Rosh Yeshiva of Tells, after the shir, he goes to the Rosh Yeshiva and he says, "Can I please come to learn in Tells?" He said, "You're aware of the fact, and I don't even know anymore. Like, I'm already 43. As much as I convince people of this, people can't believe I'm that old. But I was zochah to see Litvaks. People today don't even know. A Litvak is, if we have to define, very clever logician, Doni Gebrachs, like Rav Moshe used to say, fist and flace, the S and the... My friend told me he learned in Tells. He was there in the room, and Rabbi Stein, Zichron Levracha, Rav Chaim Stein, called on the phone. He said, "I'd like to make a collect phone call. My name is Stein. S is in Chicago." So there's certain things that a Litvak has, and one of them also, they don't really have a sense of humor. And they'll never admit it if they don't. So the boy said, "I want to come to Tells." And he got then he realized he's a Litvak, he can't laugh. He said, "You're a kid." He said, "But I want to come. You're a kid. You can't come." And then he told him over the shir he said on Shabbos verbatim, adding on his own chedushim. He said, "That's amazing." He said, "Now can I come to Tells?" He said, "But you're a kid. You can't do it." All right, all right. Like he got the letter, like he got into Harvard. He got so excited. He got into Tells. And he's there but a little while, and he's stricken with a malaise that was very prevalent then. And that disease was communism. And for a boy who came from a home of giving to others and providing for others, when he come home from cheder, his mother wouldn't give them a meal because she figured, "You've already eaten today at least one meal. What about the destitute? Don't have what to eat." So communism, it sounded great. I mean, no one knew yet what the reality would be. And if someone's going in the wrong direction, I don't mean east, you want west, or north, you want south, but off the derech, what's the only way to convince them to go the right way? And as we all know, screaming doesn't help, or yelling. The best way to show is by example. If you come from England, by example. And who would be a good example for this boy? None other than the Chafetz Chaim. Because they realized his potential, his ability to grow, his leadership abilities. So they sent him to the Chafetz Chaim. He's a young boy. He wasn't even bar mitzvah. And he hears the Chafetz Chaim shrieking. He was dining for a woman in a nearby town. She was in childbirth. It wasn't going well. So she told her husband to go to, maybe she give names, Shirley, that's not her name, but we'll call her Shirley. Shirley told Herschel, her husband, to go tell the Chafetz Chaim to pray on her behalf. And here's the way the man is shrieking and dying for a man he never met and probably will never see. He said, this is my Rebbe and I'll never leave. And in one fell swoop, communism leaves his head. And he learns by the Chafetz Chaim, his Chavrusa is Rabbi Chana Wasserman, the Chafetz Chaim's Talmud Mivak. They say that he was the more clever of the Chavrusa. And the Chafetz Chaim told his Talmidim that if you go out to become a Rav, make sure you go to a town where there's a yeshiva. I'm presuming the reason for this was that no matter how wonderful a town is, if there's a yeshiva in town, it's going to have more of an influence. If there's a kollel in town, it's going to have more of an influence. I just came out with a book about Rabbi Kelemer from West Hempstead. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, you even know where West Hempstead is, but that town changed dramatically because of him. But still a yeshiva, one person, no matter how big a tzaddik you are, can't do what a yeshiva or a kollel can do for a town. There's a story which is told, I've heard told about several people, including the Panovitcher Rav. I already gave away my drama of who I'm talking about. Sorry about that. That a fellow came to town, and he's looking for a son-in-law. He went to Rashiv and said, who's the best Talmud you have? He said, they're all the best. But who's the one who's like your son? They're all like my son. Who's like your only son? They're all like my only son. This is a very unproductive conversation. It happened then, it happened now. He said, you know what? Go into Beis Medrash, deliver a shir. At the end, ask a piercingly analytical question. Whoever can answer, you'll know that one is the best. And that's what he does. He gives a shir and he asks a very shver, a difficult question on a Rambam. Silence. No one can answer. No. So he gets back into the wagon, onto the next village, he'll do the same routine. And running after the wagon, says, Rebbe, gefragt der shver Rambam, he asked our question. What's the answer? He said, oh, that's my son-in-law. He doesn't know, but he wants to know. That's the one that I want. I heard about the Golden Events, but I also heard this said about the Panovitcher Rav. So Reb Leib Vilkamir, Reb Leib Rubin from the town of Vilkamir, takes Yosef Shlomo Kuler as a son-in-law. They get married, and he moves to a town, Vij, a Lithuanian town without a yeshiva. But Reb Chafetz Chaim said you need to have a yeshiva, so he builds a yeshiva. Kol Tianan, another town he goes to, no yeshiva, he builds a yeshiva. This teaches him architecture, engineering, and most importantly, how to raise money. For everyone knows, you can't have a yeshiva and you can't have a kollel unless there's funding. I'm way ahead of myself, but there's so little time. The Panovitcher Rav is going to become the most famous fundraiser in the history of history. So much so that in 1969 there was a great debate if there was life on the moon. The debate was predicated by the lunar landing. And everybody was arguing if there is moon, if there is life, if there isn't life. So the Satmar Rebbe said, I know for sure there's no life on the moon. How do you know? All the scientists are arguing, how do you know? He said, simple. If there'd be life on the moon, the Panovitcher Rav would have gone there collecting. Where didn't he go? Or another story that Again, we're ahead of ourselves, but in the midst of World War II, I haven't even gotten him to Eretz Yisrael yet. He has not yet the Panovich Rav yet, but in World War II, he's in Eretz Yisrael, and then orphans start trickling in, and he stops everything which he's doing. And it's an amazing thing. He's building a yeshiva. In the midst of World War II, whoever has their wits about them goes to Kevar Rachel and says, Kapitel Tillim. Rama is already El Arish, which is a stone's throw from Eretz Yisrael, the mighty German army. And he's building yeshiva. And not just building yeshiva. The grand staircase of Panovich was larger than any yeshiva that existed in Israel. Just the staircase. And that's what he's building in the midst of World War II. And then orphans started coming in. He stopped everything which he was doing to devote his attention to take care of the orphans. He made homes for them, batei avos, for men and for women, boys and for girls. He slept with them. He would go into the orchards with them, hold their hands, sing the ghetto songs. And he had to raise money for them. And he was in a suburb of Detroit, and a very wealthy woman, smart aleck, she wasn't religious, she said, Rabbi, I like what you're doing for the orphans, but we don't share the same agenda. You know, the Yarmulke, it sits, this is not for me. He said, fair enough. He said, I'll give you money, but I can't have it. I said, fair enough. And she gave him money for the school, provided no Yarmulke tzitzis. And that was the first Beis Yaakov of Bnei Brak. With his wit, you couldn't. And one last story. That always means one more last one. But there was a man with very deep pockets. I happen to know who this is, who this was. A doctor. Not a religious man, but his precursors were religious. And the Panovich Rav came to his home, and on the wall was a painting of his grandfather Yid with the Hadras Panim Peis coming down, a beer. He said, oh, but I would give that this painting during the library in Panovich. He said, do you really mean it? He said, oh, if only this painting could grace the library in Panovich. Now, this doctor knew that Panovich was not a fly-by-night yeshiva. He knew it was an important institution. He said, Rabbi, are you pulling my leg? No, I mean everything. If only this painting adorned the library in Panovich. He said, tell me, Rabbi, how much of a library do you have? He said, so far, just the painting. Needless to say, he got the doctor to pay for the books to go around the painting. So by building yeshivas, he learned all about not just engineering, but also how to raise money. And at one point, he had shilas that were very important, and he had to go to the Gadol Hador, which will be a wonderful... I just know what we're doing next time, Bezer Shem. And that was of Chaim Weiser. It's so amazing, a man, at the period of a time of the Chafetz Chaim, the Brisker Rav, and the Chazon Ish, and the Or Sameach, everyone understood the Gadol Hador of Chaim Weiser, but a name that is not well known. And he's talking to Chaim Weiser, and Chaim Weiser says, go home. But he's just in the middle of a sentence, he says, go home. He's not about to argue with the Gadol Hador. It's not as if there's a taxi waiting outside, but there was a horse and buggy. He gets in the horse and buggy, he goes home. And as soon as he gets home, they close the border. Had he not left at that moment, he would not have been reunited with his family. The next time he meets with Chaim Eiser was 9 years later at the Knesset Gedola. Chaim Eiser resumed talking in the middle of the sentence where they left off. As a little boy, I heard a story that there was a guy was walking with his friend in a town. He was a visitor. And he said, this barber over here is an Indian. This Indian, not like Indian, like American Indian, Native American. He said, this Indian has the best memory in the world. I said, really, really? Try him. He said, what did I have for breakfast? He said, eggs. He said, whoa, it's amazing. Anyways, 3 years later, he's in the same town. He goes to him, how? He said, scrambled. So, anyways, the Panovich Rav, they just took off. 9 years later, they resumed the conversation where they had left off. And when he comes home, there are four shtari rabbanus, as it's called, four invitations to be a Rav in the mailbox. One is to be a Rav in the community in Israel with the largest Jewish population, which is, of course, Tel Aviv. The second is an invitation to go to Berlin, to go from Hildesheimer, the Rabbinische Seminary, maybe I'm wrong with the name, but to take over from the Rabbinische Seminary in Berlin. The third is to go to Dvinsk. Who is in Dvinsk? Of course, in Vince was the Ur Sameach. Contemporaneously also was the Ragat Shavar Gaon. I'm just saying this because I tried this on my seminary students. It's such a great story. Yeshiva Light will love it, but it doesn't work with girls. But, you know, when you have two mega gedolim, like, in this one little town, the Ur Sameach and the Ragat Shavar, what would happen if they would have a dispute? Who in the world could adjudicate? And it once happened. There was a dispute, and they didn't know what to do. Who's right? So the Ragat Shavar suggested, I think this is in the name of the Nesivis, Das Bal Batm Hebchutas Torah, let's call over Balabas. Whatever Balabas says, one who's not learned, whatever they say will be the opposite of Das Torah. They called over Balabas, and he told him the dilemma, and he said, like the Ragat Shavar. So the Ragat Shavar said, I didn't know he's such a Balabas. I went around two times. So obviously I'm right. And Or Sameach, I think we know, when I was a little boy, I read three and a half stories about him. I named the child after him just because of it. There was a dispute in Dvinsk, two balabatim over a plot of land, and it came to a very heated dispute. And he said, it's mine, and you're a ganav, and you're a creep, and you're a nefarious, pernicious, Machiavellian, diabolic, sinister, iniquitous, back and forth. They went before the Or Sameach, and as soon as they get before the Or Sameach, they start arguing again. This is my land, he stole from me, and this creep stole it from me, and this nefarious, pernicious, Machiavellian. And the Or Sameach said, I can't adjudicate until I actually see the plot of land. He was old, he walked with a shtekin, with a walking stick. He walked out to the plot of land, and they started arguing, this is the land that he stole from me, and this land is grabbed from me. And the Or Sameach said in Yiddish, he plunged his walking stick into the ground. He said, land, land. This one says you're mine. This one says you're mine. Little do they realize, but a little while, both of them will be 6 feet under and they will belong to you. With that note of sobriety, they came to an amicable solution. There was a woman in Dvinsk whose baby would not nurse on Shabbos or Yontif. You know the Tosfos in Baba Kama. So, yes. So he based this on the Tosfos. He said, what you should do, he said to the woman, is don't, and when you feed your baby on Shabbos and Yontif, wear your weekday clothing. And the baby nursed. What he figured out was that the baby didn't recognize the scent of the Shabbos clothing and felt it was a stranger, was uncomfortable. Put on your weekday clothing, the baby nursed. Yisr Harel, if that name is not familiar to you, was the founder of Israel's secret service, the Mossad. His first major operation was the capture of Eichmann in 1960. Yisr Harel was a Dvinsker. Now, we call Dvinsk because we can't pronounce it. The real name of the city is Dvokolnitsky, Schnitzky, Schnitzelberg, etc. So we contracted it into Dvinsk. But there are many towns that you never find on a map, but we have our own name. For example, Brisk, you won't find on a map, because really it's Brest-Litovsk. Or Satmar is St. Marie. You understand why they changed that one. So Dvokolnitsky, Schnitzky, Schnitzelberg is really, we called it Dvinsk. And it's named after, like many towns, like Vilna, named after the river. And Yisr Harel writes, and you can read this in his biography. I'm not recommending it, but I read it. He came on Shabbos, it looked like the Dvokolnitsky, Schnitzky, Schnitzelberg River was about to overflow. It was an early thaw, and it would deluge the town. So they went to Or Sameach. He was there, Yisr Harel. He wasn't, I guess maybe he was from at that time. And he was wearing a talis, and he couldn't talk because it was the middle of davening. He went down to the river, and he gesticulated down, and the river receded. So Yisr Harel, the head of Israel's secret service, let out the secret. Or Sameach was the greatest of the great. And he turned down that shteller as well. And he went to a town we never heard of called Ponovitch. We don't know why. And from thereafter, he's going to be called the Ponovitch Rav. Now, we have this romantic concept of a shtetl where when the woman lights candles Friday night, the floor is already moist from her tears, and the aroma of kugel is wafting through the cobblestone alleyways, and there's a fiddler on the roof. And that's hardly the case. Many of the shtetlach were not religious. Some of them were partially religious. The town of Telz was a frumstettel. It was a one college town. Older was the yeshiva. Panovich was a large town. It was mostly not religious. But when the Panovich Rav came there, this is after World War I, where there were yesomim and widows. People were wen and weft and very impoverished. And the Panovich Rav dedicated himself to everyone. He made no distinction, religious, not religious. And he captured the hearts of Panovichian Jewry. And they decide that thanks to him, there'll be no public Chilul Shabbos before Hesia. No, thanks to him. At one time, there was a barber. You know, you have to nip something in the bud. A barber who kept the shop open, already late Friday afternoon. And when he heard about this, the Panovich Rav walked in and just stuck his head inside the barber shop. And that was enough, and everyone said, Good Shabbos, and they closed down the shop. 1 week later, it's already Friday night, and he still had customers. He comes inside, walks in all the way, and he says, Good Shabbos to everyone, and everyone is so embarrassed, and they run home. And the third week, he's still open. He goes in, he walks into the shop, and the barber says, Okay, I got the message. No. He sits down in the chair. He said, I'm not leaving here until you commit that there'll be no more Chilul Shabbos in Panovich. And that was the end of it. Now in Panovich, thanks to the Panovich Rav, he instilled such a love of Torah with everyone that on Friday night, the shul in Panovich looked like yeshiva looks like on Leil Shavuos. If you don't come on time, you can't get a seat. But what about the Balabatim? The Balabatim, the shurim, by the way, began at 12 o'clock midnight. Most people we know, 12 o'clock midnight on a Friday night, they're deep into horizontal hold, puffing for hours, and that's when the shurim began. But what about the Balabatim? They want to go to shurim, and outside Fatunkelfenster, it is so dark. The streets are sheets of ice. If you go on those freezing streets, you could have an orthopedic problem for the rest of your life. So what did they do? What they did was they crawled on all four, through the ice and the snow and the sleet, not to miss out in the shurim. That was the Abba's Torah he instilled in Panovich. You're familiar with the term Yarchekala. I believe the term comes from the Savarayim, but basically he made it up. In the summer, the boys would go home from yeshiva, and the men and the women and the children would come. And he was so committed giving Torah to everyone. And the phraseology is so important. He said that everyone has to view themselves as a Ben Torah. Some people have a Ben Zmanim of 3 weeks, from Yud Av till Rosh Chodesh. And other people have a Ben Zmanim of 11 months. But everyone is a Ben Torah. So he's in Panovich. Now when he came to Rav in Panovich, there was always, in every community, there were two rabbis. There was the Ashkenazic rabbi and the, no, there's no Sephardic rabbi in Lithuania. There was the what? Very good. I was going to have a lot of drama here and you stole it from me. I was going to say, and there's the Hasidic rabbi, no, there's no Hasidic rabbi in Lithuania. Mitamim Mishallah. There was the Rav, the Talmud Chacham, the Yari Shamayim, and then there was the stooge, the faker, the charlatan, the government appointee. And the Panovich Rav didn't want anyone else to undercut the work that he was doing, so he wanted to become also the government appointee. But you couldn't be a government appointee unless you spoke the language. You had to speak Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Russian. The Rabbana spoke Yiddish. So as soon as he became Rav in Panovich, he went on vacation for 2 weeks. He took with him a textbook and learned Lithuanian. That sounds impressive, but to realize how impressive it is, we've all learned Hebrew for 12 years. We can't speak a word. My friend David Orlovsky says, I'm in Israel 30 years. I forgot all my English. I can't learn, but I don't know a word of Hebrew. So we can't speak Hebrew. So he spoke Lithuanian. He was nominated to the Lithuanian parliament, the same. The parliament in Poland had the same name. It was called the same. Who do we know is the parliament in Poland? Very good, Rav Meir Shapiro. My chavrusa told me that, you know, that emes is the most grounded word there is. It's the first letter, the last letter, the middle letter, the aleph bet. Every letter has two legs. Sheker is the opposite. One letter, the last letter is kufrei shin, sheker. So my friend told me, my chavrusa told me that a fellow, the Rav Meir Shapiro came out of the Polish parliament, and a peddler was selling socks. He said, "You can't sell socks here." He said, "Why not?" "It's sheker ein la raglayim." So I told the story to Ravigdor Nevensal, and he said, on the spot, he said, "If that's the case, you can't sell hats in the Knesset." I said, "Why not?" "Ein lahem rosh." Okay, we got 2 minutes to end this story, so listen really quickly. So the Panovich Rav, he's a member of parliament, and then World War II breaks out, and thousands of Lithuanian refugees flee into Lithuania. The Lithuanians don't want them. What to do with them? He said, "Well, everyone understands, if you have the head of an anti-Semite, that the Jews control America. They control the media, the radio, the politics, the newspapers, and the real insiders knew that the genuine name of the President of the United States was Franklin Delano Rosenfeld. So we have a Jewish member of parliament, we'll send him to America." His route was Panovich, Kovna, Rome, Berlin, Vienna, onto Israel. That means, with rabbinic regalia, going to the head of fascist Italy, the capital of Nazi Austria, the capital of Nazi Germany. This is not just going into the lion's den, this is going into the voracious jaws of the lion. And somehow he managed, and he escaped, and he wasn't touched. He comes there to Israel, and he comes to Bnei Brak, which is an arid patch of sand. He says, "Here'll be a yeshiva. Here'll be a kollel. Here'll be another yeshiva. Nebuch, the man's dreaming." He left behind in Europe his wife that was murdered, his children that were butchered, all of his talmidim, all gone. His essay, his magnum opus, 6 cartons of shas, gone. Nebuch, he's dreaming. He said, "Yes, I'm dreaming, but my eyes are open." And he had that vision to build. When he was a young boy, his mother took him to an eye specialist in Königsberg. And the doctor diagnosed one eye is far-sighted, one eye is short-sighted. He said, "That's very, very advantageous. One eye will always be resting. Thus saith the doctor." But we interpreted one eye was always set on the future, one was set on the present. He's able to see the future and the present. He's able to build. He told people, like I told you, he built the yeshiva, which is so large, in the midst of World War II. And we're going to have to do a part. I can recommend a book about the Panovich Rav, but our time has lapsed. Thank you, Kodlo, very much. And outside, I have some books. I think you'll find them enriching. I know I will. Thank you.